my husband and I knew from the beginning that we would have to use IVF. My husband had had a previous vasectomy, and so we went to see a reproductive endocrinologist to find out that IVF with a sperm retrieval surgery was going to be our only opportunity to get pregnant. What we didn't know was how complex and lengthy the process would be. So we thought this would be an easy, like, you know, surgery for him, one round of IVF for us, and we would have a baby. Our first round of IVF, we ended up with an ectopic pregnancy, and I got to be a patient in my own emergency department. So that was a little bit interesting. We kept going, and we had multiple rounds between fresh embryo transfers and frozen embryo transfers. After two failed rounds of IVF, I finally gave in and had laparoscopy. I really struggled with that. I was convinced I would end up with a small bowel obstruction down the road. I still may, who knows? But the next two rounds immediately following that, which were in like the 6 month period where they were convinced that I would be the most successful, both rounds we did injections and failed to even get to the retrieval process. So that was very stressful because basically I did surgery for no reason. After that, this was about a year later after we had started, we finally got another embryo and it didn't survive being thawed. So we were all ready to do a frozen embryo transfer and we went in to find out that our little embryo had not survived. And then from there, we did, I think, our next round. So it was actually our fourth egg retrieval at that point. We were able to get four embryos and I finally got pregnant with the first transfer from those four embryos. Unfortunately, our story couldn't just end there. Like, I had like all sorts of challenges, I would say, along the way. About the 6 week mark, I had a subchorionic hemorrhage. You know, as an EM physician, I've never seen so much blood. Honestly, I was convinced we lost the pregnancy. I got to go through kind of that like early possible loss. And then had like a very easy, honestly, second and third trimester. And then at the very end, ended up with severe preeclampsia, was hospitalized for a week in the ICU after my child was born, and was told I will not have any more children. We did end up with a healthy baby 3 years after we started, and he's now almost 4 years old, and it's amazing.
Welcome to EM Pulse, bringing research and expert opinion to the bedside.
We're your hosts, Julia Magana
and Sarah Medeiros.
Welcome to EM Pulse.
You just heard Dr. Melissa Parsons' story of her struggle to get pregnant.
And you know, Sarah, she is not alone. In our field, a quarter of female emergency medicine physicians report infertility. A quarter of us.
Yeah, there are very few health issues that affect that proportion of any group of people.
And that's why we need to talk about it today.
Getting pregnant is just one step in the unique challenge of making and maintaining a new life in addition to thriving as an emergency medicine physician. So with this episode, we are launching a three-part series in honor of Women's History Month. Part one is about infertility. Part two will be about the pregnancy experience as emergency physicians. And last but not least, part three will delve into the challenges of breastfeeding in the ED.
So you are going to want to subscribe to EM Pulse now so you don't miss any of those episodes. Also, I want to give a shout out to the women of emergency medicine who made this episode possible. AWEM, or the Academy for Women in Academic Emergency Medicine, is a community of SAEM. And we put out a call for experts on their listserv, and we were overwhelmed with wonderful experts.
Yeah, in fact, that is how we connected with Dr. Melissa Parsons, who's our expert today. She's an emergency medicine physician at the University of Florida College of Medicine in Jacksonville, and she's also the residency program director there.
Welcome, Melissa. Let's get started with what are some of the challenges that emergency medicine physicians face specific to fertility?
Sure. So some of that hasn't been proven necessarily yet of what in our job makes us more likely to have infertility struggles. However, we have been able to show that the infertility rates for emergency medicine physicians are about 24.9% compared to the national average, which at the time of our study was 12.1%. I think it's gone up a little bit in the last few years. Some of the things that we were able to see in our study were that age is a large component. And so we do wait longer than women who aren't physicians in some cases. So just waiting till you get through your residency or till you start your career, things like that may increase our risk for infertility. And then we were able to show an association potentially with night shift, but not causative data, meaning we can't say night shifts cause infertility, but we were able to show that women who had infertility also reported working more night shifts than the women in our study who did not have infertility.
Oh, that's super interesting.
But it does fit with some other studies that have looked at shift work in nursing and other healthcare specialties, you know, and that night shift may negatively impact our natural circadian rhythms, our hormones, things like that, that then could impact fertility.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. So when we're looking at fertility issues and that higher percentage, is that specific to emergency medicine or is that just for medicine in general?
So the studies have been done across a bunch of specialties. The study that I published a few years back now looked specifically at emergency medicine physicians, and we had results from over 2,000 female emergency medicine physicians. So we looked only at EM. There have been other studies that have looked at specialty-specific, like different surgical specialties, and they had similar rates ranging from like 18 to, I think, 25, 26%.
So for those who may not be a physician and are listening to this podcast, or maybe a male and may not understand why you would wait, why is it that women physicians start having families so much later?
You know, the training is certainly part of it. I think we're going through med school. Let's say you go straight through, which in this day and age is not as common. I think the 1, 2, 3 gap years prior to going to medical school is much more common. But if you went straight through, theoretically, you're graduating college around 22, let's say. And if you started med school right then, you'd be graduating med school at 26. And then let's say shortest case scenario, you do a 3-year residency. So you're looking at graduating at 29-ish to 30. So if you wait till you start your career, you're already in your 30s before you're even starting to consider having children. Now, if you were to start during your training, you know, I think that is more common in this kind of day and age, but I will say there's still a lot of stigma to that at some places. I know my first day of residency, I was the only married female in my class, and I was told I would not have children during my residency training and I would be provided birth control.
What?
Yes, this was a decade ago now, so I'm showing my age to a degree. But that was what I was told by my chief resident starting residency.
That is super invasive, highly inappropriate.
And we've worked really hard to change that for our residency program. And I have multiple residents right now that are having babies during their residency. And I think we really have to support that because there are going to be risk factors if we ask people to wait until they're 30 or older. And I don't know that our career really gets easier. You know, we keep working nights. There are some other specialties where you do a lot of nights during your training and then you have less and less and less nights. But we keep working nights until late in our career or for our entire career. And I think that that is something we have to consider.
And it is challenging to have a child, right? Like that's, I think, a universal thing that everybody recognizes. You're going to lose some sleep. It's very time consuming. It's a fantastic, wonderful gift of life, but it is a very time consuming one. And residency training, medical training is like another child. And so you have 2 monster time sucks, energy sucks, life sucks that happen at the same time is like physically challenging for anybody, right? And you're going to miss out on some of those moments because you're in such a time consuming phase of your training and career. So that was something that I worried about when I chose to delay starting to have kids until after my training as well, or at least one of my phases of training, because I couldn't delay until I was all the way done or I would be like 50. But I did worry about that, about missing out on that opportunity and then trying to feed these two monsters in my life at the same time. And then I think it is fair to say that most training programs have not a lot of wiggle room as far as extra work goes. We don't have like two residents that are just sitting there waiting to fill in shifts if somebody goes out on maternity leave. And frankly, you would need more than two residents to fill in some of those shifts and them continue on their other work. And so there's not a ton of wiggle room with inside of most training programs. And if you are, you know, quotes, dependent upon that trainee to do that work, the rest of the trainees can then have to do more work with that traditional program. And that can feel bad as somebody who wants to be a team player and also to other people that are on the team. And so to me, those were major detractors as to why I waited until I was at least done with residency to have a kid.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of challenges as somebody who has now adjusted our what we call our master rotation schedule or our resident schedule of the year for multiple medical leaves or family leaves. It is a challenge. And how do you make it not negatively impact the other residents and move things around? And a lot of it depends, honestly, on how quickly you're told about this so that you can make arrangements. One of the things that we've tried to be cognizant of is trying to move people so we're not taking somebody out of the emergency department, because then there is a big workload on other people. But how can we get creative about moving things around? And you still have to meet ABEM guidelines. And because it's a strict like year policy, that really impacts their ability to take leave. So trying to make sure that we're supporting people who do want to have kind of those two children at the same time between the residency and a physical child, I think is a challenge. I've actually joked that I think really the easiest time, which I don't think any of these times are easy, to be fair, but I think the easiest time might actually be when you're a med student, because you aren't actually necessary to be there. But at the same time, I cannot imagine having a child when I was trying to consume all of that information and, you know, the hours I was putting in medical school, honestly. So I think part of our career is you learn and do so much in, I mean, I say a short period of time, but there's a lot of years involved with that. And there's not really a correct time or a convenient time. I think there are ways where we could better support women and our male physicians who have families in medical school or residency with childcare and things like that. But I think it's a struggle no matter what time you do it, you know. Egg freezing is actually an option now. At our hospital, we have insurance coverage for infertility treatments now for physicians, but also for egg freezing. And I think that that's an interesting option. Maybe I would have chosen to take advantage of it a decade ago had it been an option. But I do think it allows you a little bit more time to make those decisions and you don't have to feel quite as rushed.
Okay, so we have established that fertility is a reality for a lot of Americans and is a little bit worse for physicians in general. Maybe those night shifts make us at a little bit of a higher risk with continuing to do that for the rest of our lives, our rest of our working lives anyways. Kind of walk us through what the process of identifying that you have fertility problems look like as a physician. Walk us through those next phases.
Sure. I think it's probably a little bit different for all of us as physicians, and especially as emergency medicine physicians. We connect with so many different specialties that we probably do have some connections with OB, potentially with REI, and by REI, reproductive endocrine, specializing in infertility, which is helpful. But I think for most women physicians, we would be looking at trying to conceive for typically the correct answer is a year. Because of our connections, sometimes we may not wait that long. And especially, honestly, depending on what your age is, if I were trying to conceive at 35, I don't know that I would wait a year. A year is a long time as far as infertility goes. And we have potentially more medical knowledge than the layperson of like what things we should be doing to try to conceive. And so if we're doing the right things along the way and it's not happening, like reaching out to an OB consultant that you know and trying to set up an appointment probably makes a lot of sense. And then they would refer you potentially to a reproductive endocrinologist who will, you get a lot of testing upfront, you and your partner. So everybody gets to get poked and prodded a little bit for some testing. Then you kind of go from there and they'll lay out options because it's not just IVF. There's a lot of kind of other things that can come into play before then with different treatments like intrauterine insemination, you know, or just fertility boosting drugs like Clomet, things like that.
That sounds very emergency medicine to be like, oh, I don't have time for that. Let me call up my buddy who can help me through this. That is so emergency medicine applied to just life. I love it. Okay, so once you have tried these alternative things, you end up down the route of IVF. Tell us what that looks like for a physician or a provider in emergency medicine.
Sure. So at the shop I used, you get a spreadsheet with a calendar. And basically, it's like all these days where you're going to give yourself injections, you're going to need ultrasounds, all sorts of things that are based off of like a normal human 9-to-5 schedule, none of which we work. So one of the challenges really with being able to do this was I really had to take time off, like 2 weeks off, to accomplish this, or I had to set a bunch of shifts to like the 3-to-11 time frame, which then also wasn't great, you know, from a sleep standpoint necessarily, but I had to make sure I was available to go in any day because they'd be like, basically you're taking a bunch of injections to grow as many follicles on your ovaries as you can, and then you get to go in and have a transvaginal ultrasound like sometimes every other day, sometimes daily, for a number of days in a row to try to figure out when exactly you can have an egg retrieval. And then they will tell you, like, okay, your egg retrieval is in 2 days. So you don't know when this procedure will be. And you can just imagine, like, trying to tell people, well, now I can't work any of these shifts because I have to have a procedure and all of that. So I really ended up taking, when I knew when I was going to be scheduled, I would take 2 weeks off of my schedule to be able to do this, which is just not very easy for any of us as EM physicians or really any kind of physician. So I was very lucky that I was able to kind of shift my schedule around. You probably could get away with just doing a week, but it is challenging. Then basically, it really depends on whether you do a frozen embryo transfer, because then your cycle would be concluded after the egg retrieval. Or if you're going to do a fresh transfer, then you wait, I want to say it was like 5 days. I honestly forget that part, but it's like a set number of days, 3, 5, 7 days, something like that. And then you go back and have the embryo transferred. So that next procedure is also very dependent on when the first procedure is, and it's all very set in stone. And that was why I ended up taking quite a bit of time off work.
I mean, that sounds super time consuming, very important, but very time consuming. Okay, so everybody's going to be different. Recognize that. Different places that you work at, different personalities and how much you want to share. But what do you recommend for people who are facing IVF for having those conversations with their colleagues and other people when they have to take time off for the schedule? What do you recommend that they communicate to the rest of their department?
That is going to be very person dependent. So I shared my infertility journey very publicly. So it was relatively easy for me to talk to people about it. I also became a patient at my own hospital multiple times. So it was actually a benefit that I was very open about the experience, because if I was trying not to be, I basically would have outed myself anyway. So my chair was very supportive and actually allowed me, I was the scheduler at the time, which does make life easier in a lot of ways. So he was very supportive of, I was allowed to like block my night shifts and not have any night shifts for like the month leading up to my procedure. I would do them all way in advance. And then obviously my shop, we have paid vacation. So I was able to use my vacation and save it to do these. So in that time that I was taking off, I really didn't have to tell anybody kind of what exactly was happening. I really got to be out. But I was pretty open about what was going on. And I think one of the benefits of that is that my trainees who have come after me with all of their struggles have come to me about infertility struggles, or like I'm the person everybody tells in our group when they're pregnant because, you know, they want to share it with somebody that feels safe and that can help them prepare for what's coming next. So it really is going to be a who you are, how you deal with things kind of decision. I still think the best thing that I did during infertility was talk about it and find other people who had similar challenges that could be kind of my sounding board. So I actually had a group of three other female physicians, all different specialties, and we were all doing IVF at the same time and going through it kind of together. We all ended up getting pregnant, I think within like 3 to 4 months of each other. And so then we started motherhood kind of simultaneously as well. But we live all over the country. There's an anesthesiologist, a pediatric ICU physician, and a GI doc, and me. And we all kind of did it together and supported each other through it. And I do think having a support group of other women specifically who are going through IVF is very important, because the hormones make you a little, I don't like to say crazy, but they just make you different than you've ever felt. And so knowing that that's normal and that other people are feeling it too is something that even a partner, you know, can't necessarily support you through. So for me, talking about it was my therapy and how I got through it. And sharing it at work to some degree was a benefit to me, but that may not be true or safe for everybody.
Yeah. And let's talk about that. What are some of the challenges to having those types of conversations on a more public level?
It's a hard question to ask me because I've been very open about it. You know, I shared my story on Instagram the day that sticks out the most. So we went in for a frozen embryo transfer. First of all, the drugs are ridiculously expensive. And that should be the first thing that we try to change about this system, because I just can't understand how we're paying so much for these drugs. But you do all these drugs to get your body ready to get pregnant, basically. And so we went in for our frozen embryo transfer. I had one embryo. And they put us in this room that wasn't our normal room. We'd been through this a bunch of times. We knew what to expect. And nothing was normal. And so we knew something was off. And finally, the physician came in. He was wearing a Mardi Gras outfit, which I will probably never forget, and told us that our embryo had not survived being thawed. So we were not doing a transfer that day. And we would have to do an entire another round of IVF. And it was just this like soul-crushing moment of, this is not at all what we were expecting to happen today. But my girlfriend and I were supposed to do like an Instagram live that night about the frozen embryo transfer. And so she immediately was like, we're canceling, you can't do this. And I was like, no, like, let's do it. Like, you know, this is still something we should talk about. And it sucks. But if somebody else like can be impacted by what I'm going through, that makes it more reasonable or more, I don't know. I was able to find a benefit in kind of the struggles that we went through because I was able to share it with other people. And they would reach back, you know, people would message me and be like, thank you so much. This is what's happened, you know. And so you've seen like the connection that comes from sharing these struggles. And I think that this was something that was silenced for so long and not talked about, that all of a sudden, like women feeling like this is okay for us to talk about, this isn't that I'm failing, my body's feeling anything else. This is just part of healthcare and science, and it's very normal, I think, is so important.
Yeah, I can envision those would be some of the challenges, right? Like, we're used to not failing, quote unquote, at things. We're used to being able to succeed and pull ahead, and to all of a sudden hit this spot that's outside of your control as far as like what you can physically do, I think would feel foreign to a lot of people, I can imagine, and would therefore sometimes be hard to say out loud and to put that vulnerability out there into the public, as you so kindly did. And it isn't something that has been hugely talked about within side of medicine. And so I think there might be some unfamiliarity between other physicians who haven't experienced that or haven't had to think about those things and go through that and haven't had to have that lived experience themselves, and so aren't able to relate or understand why you do need those 2 weeks off at that time period. So I think the unfamiliarity, the feeling of vulnerability from a physical and a mental standpoint could be barriers as well. But I'm hopeful that, you know, with conversations like this, I mean, this is part of why we're doing this podcast, right, Melissa, is because we want to continue this conversation. We want everybody that's listening to be able to be like, oh, that's what that's like. That's what's going on with my colleague. And hopefully make that conversation a little bit easier for the next physician down the line that is going through that.
I think control becomes a big thing. And as many of us are very type A and, you know, used to having some control of what's happening, even in the worst situations in the emergency department, sometimes we still feel like we have a little bit of control over what's going on. I think that was the real challenge of a lot of this, was there is none. And so I know, like, my thing was, okay, just let me know, like, when can I do my next cycle? I'll start planning for that. That's the only control I have. And then we just have to kind of wait and see. But control, I definitely think, is a big challenge going through IVF, and just even the scheduling component, right? It's easier to take 2 weeks off and know that you're not going to have to be stressed over swapping shifts and getting coverage and doing all of these things, you know, and that's something that we can control in that way.
All right. You mentioned harvesting and freezing eggs as being one of the ways to be able to do this. But what are some of the things that people listening to this podcast can do to minimize these fertility challenges themselves?
I'm not sure how much we can really control in terms of minimizing, you know, each of our risk for infertility. You know, are there ways where we can control our cortisol levels? Sure, but I would love to hear all of them and see science behind them. And then probably our job is probably the most negative thing for cortisol levels that we could ask for. So I'm not sure how much control we really have over that either. But I think being cognizant of what you think fits in your timeline makes sense. The one thing I was really surprised by going through is, so the reproductive endocrinologists actually really believe in the ovulation kits and will use those and then have you come in when it's positive to do blood testing. So one of my takeaways from the whole experience was, oh, those actually are relatively good for an over-the-counter thing we can get at home. If we're going to try naturally on our own and see what happens, like, that's actually something that you can use to see if you can increase your chances without having to have any sort of treatments.
Yeah, that makes sense. Very practical. Melissa, what can we do as colleagues to support colleagues who might be going through fertility issues and specifically IVF?
The first thing I tell everybody is, like, don't ask people when they're having kids, because you never know who's really struggling to have a child that hasn't felt comfortable saying anything. And that's, you know, a triggering question sometimes. And then for people who are going through treatments, you know, if they need to swap a shift, I think from a scheduling perspective, like, trying to help them manage their schedule during those times is probably the easiest thing that can help them and make them feel a little bit better. And then, you know, letting them know that you're there to support them. And if there's anything that they need, I got injections at the hospital all the time. My nurses gave me injections. My residents gave me injections. I mean, it's a very timed thing. So even something as simple as saying, hey, like, if you know this about the person and that they're going through it, hey, let me know if you need me to cover you while you do your injection tonight or anything like that, because it has to be within a very specific time frame. And so stepping in and helping somebody if they need even some coverage in the ED for 15 minutes to be able to do that is helpful.
What can departments do to support colleagues that may be going through this?
I was really happy with how my department kind of allowed me to move around my nights, especially to stack them. Like, I want to say I did them either a month or 2 months before a cycle, and I would do like a whole bunch so that I wasn't making other people pick up more nights necessarily, but they may have more in that block. but I was able to pick them up in advance. So in case I did get pregnant, I also wasn't then working a bunch of night shifts after I was pregnant, because there are concerns that that can also cause miscarriage in the first trimester. So that was one thing that was helpful. And then I was able to get on like a normal circadian rhythm for at least a month leading up to my procedure, because it cost $10,000 to $15,000, maybe even more, $1,000 to do this. And so you really want to set yourself up to have your body as ready and prepared as possible, shall we say. And so not flipping your shifts all over the place was one of the things. So I have to say that was very helpful. One of the things that our hospital instituted after, unfortunately, after I completed all of the treatments, was we have coverage now. We have insurance coverage. I think it's like a 30,000 lifetime maximum. So it honestly wouldn't have even covered all of the infertility treatment that I paid for. But that is such a huge plus, especially for residents who may not even have a physician income trying to go through this. It's such a huge plus to have some coverage for it. And so trying to make that available, since we know that we are at risk, making that available through hospital systems, I think is really important moving forward.
Anything else that you think we should know about fertility issues and IVF as physicians?
One thing that I've learned going through the process and a few other and childbirth comboed, I think every time that we get put in the patient seat instead of on the physician side of things, but really have to be on the exam table or kind of in that chair waiting for a physician to come in, those are all opportunities that we have to become better physicians. Going through kind of those struggles has really changed how I care for patients and my view as a provider, because there are so many more times now where I'm able to say, I see you, like I've been you. My physician came in Mardi Gras outfit, you know, and I have thought so many more times about what I'm wearing on holidays. You know, we all want to kind of get dressed up for like Halloween or something in the emergency department, but like I've been more cognizant of, I never want to have to walk in and tell somebody their loved one has passed, like in a Halloween costume or something like that. And just from kind of sitting in that patient seat, you see such a different side of medicine sometimes that I think it makes us much better physicians as we go through these things. And so if you're going to find a positive, which going through IVF, you have to find positives in as many things as you possibly can. I think that was one of my positive takeaways, was this is making me a better version of me and a better doctor to my patients.
I like that. Well, thank you, Melissa, for your time. I really appreciate you sharing your perspective and your expertise in this topic.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Pulse check.
25% of women in emergency medicine surveyed report infertility issues. The reality is we start having kids later in life and have a physically and mentally tough job with weird hours. These are great ingredients for an interesting career, but not for starting a family. There is no shame here, and it is the reality of our career at this point, but there are a few things we can do. Consider freezing your eggs earlier if you expect to be starting a family later. It is your story to share, and it's okay to ask for accommodations during key times. If a colleague shares their journey with you, ask how you can support them. Be considerate when they may need to swap shifts, and recognize that hormone therapy has emotional and physical side effects, and build in patience. As a department, create a culture that celebrates, not denigrates, family creation.
Well, that's it for infertility.
Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any of the upcoming episodes.
And happy National Women's History Month. Take a moment to celebrate the accomplishments of a woman in your life.
Thank you to our department for creating a culture of support for all health issues.
And thank you to OM Productions for creating Great Kids With Me. Thank you, OM Productions, for being so flexible with our schedules.
Until next time, stay curious, stay inspired, and stay tuned.